Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone. This is New Books Network, and my name is Armand Yildiz. Today, I have the great pleasure of hosting Mark David Baer to talk about his book, German, Jew, Muslim, Gay, The Life and Times of Hugo Marcus, which came out of Columbia University Press in 2020. Welcome to the New Books Network, Mark.
Thank you for having me.
Before we continue with the book, could you tell us a bit about yourself and what you do?
Well, by training, I'm actually a historian of the Ottoman Empire, of Islamic history, as well as of Jewish history. But this book is about German history, and this book is gay history, and this book is also about a convert to Islam. Now, when I was young, I grew up in part in Germany. So I already knew German, and even though professionally I became a historian of the Ottoman Empire, and I studied the Islamic languages of Arabic and Turkish and Persian, I always kept close ties to Germany. I lived there, I visited there, and so when I was in Berlin, actually, I was following the followers of a 17th century Ottoman Jewish messianic figure named Shabbatai Tzvi. And his followers spread out across Europe, and the descendants of his followers were also in Germany. So I was in Berlin, actually studying, learning about, researching what I normally do, which is Ottoman history, Ottoman Jewish history, conversion to Islam. And I found out that the leading Turkish citizen in Nazi Berlin was in fact a descendant of these Jewish followers of the 17th century Ottoman messianic figure Shabbatai Tzvi. So I was writing about that. But then some colleagues of mine told me that actually across town at Berlin's only mosque at the time in Nazi Germany, the leading Muslim was also a Jew. Was a Jewish convert to Islam. And I thought, well, I've already written three books about converts to Islam. And even though this is German history, why don't I take a look? And why don't I leave Ottoman history, Turkish history behind, and let me follow my interest in the intersection, the connected histories between Muslims and Jews. And so I began to learn about this fascinating figure named Hugo Marcus. Now, Hugo Marcus was relatively unknown. There had been a few biographical entries published about him in various gay and also German encyclopedic works, but these were full of factual inaccuracies. There also was a couple of pages about him in one of the first histories of Muslims in Germany. But again, that was also filled with inaccuracies. And one of the photos that appeared in that book, the book by Manfred Backhausen, which is an outstanding book, maybe the only photo of Marcus that appeared in that book was of him wearing a fez, so an oriental costume. And so this, I thought this was misleading in a way. Because as I began to read his published as well as his unpublished work, I realized this was a man who was seeking to bring together Germanness and Muslimness. He was certainly no Orientalist.
And I mean, at the same time, this interest in Islam and his conversion to Islam, it has a lot of, I mean, intellectual historical backgrounds, including authors like Goethe, but also like other German philosophers who he compares to Islamic ethics with Kant's ethics, for instance. Would you like to talk about how this intellectual history came into play?
There were other German men of Jewish background or Christian background who also converted to Islam as Marcus did. Marcus converted probably around 1925. And around that time, other well-known figures became Muslim. So one of the most well-known is Muhammad Asad, this leading intellectual who was, like Marcus, was Jewish, although from Austria. And to Asad, one could not be European and Muslim. One could not be German or of a German-speaking cultural background and be Muslim. Asad argued in his work that in order to be Muslim, this is the 1920s, 1930s, one had to leave Europe. And one had to, as he did, he went to Arabia. He learned Arabic. He dressed as an Arab. He married a series of Muslim women. This was his vision. This was, he saw, Muhammad Asad saw that everything was wrong with Christian culture, with German culture, with European culture. And what he found for himself as a solution was to leave it behind physically, intellectually, and to enter into the Islamic cultural realm. Now, Marcus, again, an unknown figure, more or less unknown figure, had the opposite view. Marcus believed, and there are German Muslims today who would agree with him, that being German and being Muslim are not contradictory, that one could fulfill the tenets of German culture and Islamic culture without any contradiction. In other words, Marcus believed that the values of Islam and the values of German culture were the one and the same. Now, I'm not arguing this is the case, but this is what he argued. And there were other like-minded German converts in the 1920s who, like some of the Muslims in Berlin today at German, almost exclusively German mosques, German ethnically German mosques, German-speaking mosques, also believe that Germans, in a way, can be the best Muslims. So as I read Marcus's the sermons, the preachings, the lectures he gave at the mosque in the 20s and 30s, as I read his philosophical works, as I read his private letters, this picture of a man emerged. A man who believed, and this goes to your question, a man who believed that actually Goethe, the great thinker, writer, German cultural figure, Goethe, was in fact his model for becoming Muslim. Now, we know that Goethe was not a Muslim. Goethe did not believe in organized religion. Some saw Goethe as a prophet. And in fact, Goethe wrote about this moving line between prophecy and poetry. And so Goethe was intrigued by the figure of Muhammad and the borderline between when is one a poet and one is when does one cross over and start doing what is divine or carrying out God's message as a prophet. So Goethe wrote about this, and Marcus was intrigued by this writing, and Marcus believed, as did other German Muslims in the 20s and also today, that Goethe, because he was so sympathetic to Islam and wrote such positive things about Muslim that no other Germans wrote, he had his famous, he wrote a poem called the Muhammad's Poem, in which it's really quite a beautiful, ecstatic poem. So no other figures in German culture in that time period, the 18th century, early 19th century, were so sympathetic to Islam. So Marcus believed, as I mentioned, like others, that actually and taking some of Goethe's own lines from his poetry or from West East Divan, he believed that he actually meant it when he said that that we all are Muslim, we all live and die in Islam. If Islam, well, you know the famous couplet. Also, you know, Goethe actually said that if someone were to say that I'm a Muslim, I'm not going to deny it. So Goethe actually said all these kind of things, and Marcus took them literally and took Goethe as a model of someone who was the pinnacle of German culture, intellectual thought, and also, he believed, a Muslim believer.
And how did Marcus's Jewish background play into this conversion? And I mean, maybe related to that, you, in my opinion, you make a very important argument about how we usually imagine cultural transmission between, let's say, Jews and Muslims. How does the story of Marcus talk to that imagination?
Well, as a number of important scholars, such as Susanna Heschel, has pointed out, there were German Jewish Orientalists in the 19th and the early 20th century whose views of Islam were more sympathetic than that of their Christian colleagues. In fact, because German Jewish Orientalists were so sympathetic to Islam, some even, again, converted to Islam, or if they didn't convert, they wrote in very, very positive ways about Islam, seeing Islam and Judaism as very similar as opposed to Christianity, seeing Islam and Judaism as religions which promote intellectual thought, rational thinking, and the life of the mind, as opposed to how they viewed Christianity. At the same time, these German Orientalists were the victims of anti-Semitism. Famously, some of them were never allowed to become full professors in Central Europe because they were Jewish, because of this anti-Jewish racism. So some of them began to depict Islam in also quite a romantic way and began to write about the tolerance of medieval Islam, medieval Islamic ruled cultures and kingdoms, and compare them favorably to Christian ruled kingdoms in medieval and pre-modern Europe. Rightly so. Christian Europe, as we know, forcibly converted, murdered, expelled Jews, whereas the Muslim kingdoms of Europe, including the Ottoman Empire, tolerated Jews, allowed them to be Jewish, and even allowed, such as the Ottomans, even allowed Jews to who had been forcibly converted to Catholicism in places such as Christian Spain, allowed them to take refuge in the Ottoman Empire and become Jewish again. So there already was a pro-Islamic Jewish view towards Islam in these centuries. And so, in a way, Marcus he taps into that. He also taps into the views of German Orientalists that Islam is a religion that favors logic and reason and rational thinking and the life of the mind. Marcus was very much not a mystic. And in fact, he even purposely misread some of Goethe's works on Islam, which today scholars interpret as see as being mystical rather than rational. But Marcus was very much viewing Islam as his other German-speaking, Central European, German Orientalist forebears.
Thinking also together what you said before about how he wasn't an Orientalist in the same sense, and how there are now today Germans who converted to Islam who follow this kind of idea of best Muslims are German Muslims. How do you see, because I mean, in, for instance, Esra Özyurek's book, we see that there's also racialized tendencies about claiming why German Islam is the best Islam. How do you see his position in relation to this?
Well, this is an intriguing point. And in my book, it one of the reviewers was very happy that I don't you know, I present Marcus in a very objective way. I mean, there's a lot of his writing one could certainly take issue with, the misogyny, for example. I mean, here was a, and we'll talk about this, here was a gay man who was constantly promoting utopias where practically there are no women. So we can talk about that. But also, it is noticeable that his Islam goes from, let's say, Muhammad directly to Goethe, and then to himself and other Germans. So he doesn't rely on that great Islamic tradition of 1,400 years of Islamic thought. It's difficult to find him making reference to any born Muslim thinker who's from the majority Muslim world. So of course Muhammad is his. Of course he's very intrigued by the character of Muhammad and his role as prophet, but there isn't any discussion of the Muslims who made the Islamic world and created and interpreted and revised Islam over the centuries. So his Islam is a very German Islam. Again, he claims that to have read the same German translation of the Quran that Goethe had read. So he's constantly, so he's making connections. He's establishing Islam in Germany. He's placing Islam in Germany in the 18th century and drawing a line from Goethe to himself. And he also talks about other characters. But again, it's very much a German Islam. It's very much an Islam of that he creates in his mind. Now, people have asked me, but was he really a Muslim though? Well, yes, he was. He converted to Islam. He practiced Islam. He prayed in the mosque, and he very much believed in the prophecy of Muhammad and the Quran as a holy book, as God's message. So there's no question that he believed and he accepted and he was a Muslim. The question is, what did his Muslim contain? And this I talk about in the book. What normally today we talk about Sunni Muslims having five pillars of practice or belief. And one of those, perhaps the first one, is the Shahada, that a Sunni, someone who converts to Sunni Islam or a believer in Sunni Islam, says that they accept that Muhammad is that there's no God except God, and Muhammad is God's messenger. Now, Marcus did not include the Shahada as one of the five pillars of Islam. So in his writings, he inserted a new pillar. And in that new pillar, he placed himself. So that new pillar includes beauty. It includes pacifism. He created a space for people like him who were different. And this is an allusion to his being gay.
And I mean, well, speaking of that, he was a close friend of Magnus Hirschfeld and was very active in the gay rights movement. Can you tell us a bit about that period as well?
Right. So Marcus, and what attracted me to writing this book, this is the first biography in any language about Marcus. And also you might wonder why hadn't anyone written a book about Marcus before? Because we have biographies of Assad, and we have biographies of the other famous Jewish convert of that day, who was Esad Bey. So we have biographies of those men. They're very well known. They're very well orientalist. They fit in certain tropes of looking at Muslims, but no one had written about Marcus. And so why is that? I mean, one reason is that he was a gay activist, and this may be why Jewish studies as well as Islamic studies scholars weren't interested in him or didn't want to write about him. Too controversial to write about a gay man. Also, the fact that he's a convert, he's a Jewish convert, may have been a reason why some other people weren't attracted to writing about him, but also because he wasn't the leader of any movement. He didn't write a bestseller like Muhammad Assad, who wrote Road to Mecca in the 50s in English. Marcus wrote in German, all of the material that I read for this book was in German, whether published or unpublished. He was somewhat known as a philosophical thinker in the early 20th century, but he didn't write, he didn't publish any path-breaking work on Islam, as Muhammad Assad did. He also didn't write any well-known fiction that's been translated to English, such as Esad Bey wrote some turgid Orientalist novels that actually a lot of Muslims were insulted by. Marcus wrote, actually he wrote two novellas, but these were gay novellas. One was in 1900, one was a dozen years after that. So he wrote fiction also published in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, gay fiction. And so Marcus gave me the opportunity to write about the gay rights movement, the history of Muslims in Germany, and also the history of Jews in Germany, and to bring those three disparate historiographies and discourses and histories together in the life of one man. And that's what attracted me to write this book. Now, your question was about his role in the gay rights movement. So again, Marcus wasn't a leader, but he was an assistant to the well-known Magnus Hirschfeld. Again, we have half a dozen biographies about Hirschfeld. Hirschfeld was a towering figure in the gay rights movement. Now, we may not accept anymore today Hirschfeld's ideas about being gay and so on, but we have to credit him with what he did. He established the first gay rights organization in the world, and this was the Scientific Humanitarian Committee before 1900. So Marcus was an early member of this group, and Marcus was Hirschfeld's assistant. They traveled around when Hirschfeld was conducting his ethnography of gay life in Berlin. Marcus was there with him as an assistant. Marcus was a writer. Marcus was a great editor, and he was a very serious person. And so people would write something, give it to Marcus to correct. So he played this supporting role. That's also why he's not well known. But so he was there with Hirschfeld for decades. Hirschfeld was older, and he was a model in a way. Marcus was also close to someone who was a couple of years younger, who was another very important gay rights activist. And of course, when you think of gay rights activists in German history around that time, who's the second person that we think about? Doesn't come to mind. I mean, so let me go back to Hirschfeld for a second. So Hirschfeld, he was always with Hirschfeld. He also Marcus even served as a character witness in different trials when gay men were put on trial. And Hirschfeld asked him to be a character witness for different men who were persecuted. So Marcus also helped pen the petitions that were given to the justice minister to repeal the infamous paragraph 175, which basically linked gay men to men who committed bestiality in the language of the law. It saw them as the same and criminalized them. So gay men were persecuted in this era. So Marcus was a very important supporting figure in petitioning the justice ministry to repeal these laws. So he always played a behind the scenes role, and Marcus was known. He was known as a gay rights supporter and fighter, and he was known from the time he joined the Scientific Humanitarian Committee before 1900, around 1900. He was well known in the gay rights struggle when he was a student at the University of Berlin, and he, throughout his life, until the end of his life in 1966, just a couple of years before he passed away, he even was able to continue to publish gay fiction in the leading gay magazine of the day, which was Der Kreis, published in Zurich.
And going back to what you said about his misogynistic utopias, would you tell us about those as well?
Yes. So in his mind, the perfect world would be something he borrowed from, well, both Plato and Nietzsche, really, brought them both together, would be this revolutionary elite, an intellectual, aristocratic, gay elite, a group of men who had the vision to rescue Germany from the abyss in which it had fallen following the First World War. So for Marcus, who was a pacifist like Hirschfeld, the First World War proved that Christian culture, German culture, needed to be redeemed. Christianity, perhaps, was, according to Marcus, was beyond the pale of redemption. It wasn't possible for Germans to be Christian and to recover from the physical losses, the cultural losses, the moral dead end that German society had entered, as proven in the First World War. Marcus saw the liberation of German society by returning to Goethe's vision of Islam and German culture. So in a way, to look forward, they had to return to Goethe's concepts. So, but this is the other interesting aspect of Marcus's life. He also believed that Goethe was gay. Now, this word gay is problematic because Marcus was a man who loved men, but wrote about it in his published and unpublished work. He wrote erotic fiction about his imam in the Berlin Mosque, for example, that he didn't publish. So Marcus was a man, he had for decades a boyfriend, a friend who was a younger man, actually a Catholic Polish man. But so Marcus loved men, but he never called himself gay. So Hirschfeld also was a man who loved men and fought for their freedom in society, but also never called himself gay. So, but of course, here we are in 2022, this is a word we used. Different words were used at the time. But the point is that Marcus believed, reading Goethe's letters, reading Goethe's poetry, reading Goethe's prose, he believed that Goethe was like him, that Goethe also believed that the best friendship, the only true friendship, is that between men. That women are distractions, they get in the way. Men only have relations, sexual relations with women to procreate, but actually the ideal human body is a male body. And Marcus, when you read Goethe's fiction, when you read his novels, you see some of the most beautiful descriptions of young nude males, and some of the most erotic passages, I quote them in the book, come from Goethe's fiction. So Marcus, in his own fiction, used Goethe's inspiration and also wrote about the relations between older men and young men. So mature men and young men, but also wrote about young men who loved each other. So he saw Goethe as both Muslim and gay, the word we would use today. And so this was a model for his utopia that he wanted this elite of Muslim, gay men, this aristocracy, this intellectual elite, that would rescue Germany after the First World War.
And I mean, with the Muslim organization he was a part of, we also see at the time when Nazis came to power, they also support the new government. And how does it play out in his life?
Well, Marcus faced a number of problems when the Nazis came to power. Now, Marcus was born in 1880. So when the Nazis come to power, he's a middle-aged man. Marcus is always portrays himself as a German patriot. Nationalist is the wrong word, but he's definitely a German patriot. He loves Germany. And when he was young, he was a member of the Wandervogel movement. But this movement, as we know, became anti-Jewish at a certain point and would expel Jewish members and would promote racist views. And Marcus was conflicted about this as well. And in one of his, in one of the things he writes about how he was on this hiking expedition in the Harz Mountains and just astonished by the beauty of his homeland. But then he writes that, but I was Jewish. And could Jews love the homeland as other Germans? And you know, so he has this, he's in a way, he's absorbed some of this anti-Semitic views of who belongs to Germany. And so this is something that he, you know, you can see in his subconscious that what he was struggling with. The fact that he was Jewish, the fact that he was a German patriot, he seems to have solved it in a way by becoming Muslim. But at the same time, he never, as long as he was able, he never left the Jewish Gemeinde. He never left the Jewish community until the Nazis put pressure on the mosque, 1935, because he was still, even after the Nazis had come to power, he was still supported by his brethren in the mosque. He was still the leader of the German Muslim Society in the mosque. He was still delivering lectures in the mosque. He was still socializing with other Germans in the mosque. But then when the Nuremberg Laws were passed, 1935, when so-called Germans were no longer allowed to socialize, mix in any way with people defined as Jewish, then this became a problem for the mosque community. And so in his autobiographical writing, unpublished, after the war, he writes that, you know, he never wanted to leave Judaism. He never wanted to stop being legally, officially Jewish. And he always kept very close relations with his Jewish family and Jewish friends and colleagues, not just Hirschfeld, but the other person whose name we were looking for earlier was, of course, Hiller, the famous Kurt Hiller, who was younger than Marcus and who actually called himself gay. And he was socialist. And he was beaten nearly to death in a concentration camp and then fled to England. So Marcus was not a communist, not a socialist. Hirschfeld was more a social democrat. Marxist was not a leftist at all. He was a German patriot. He was a centrist. He had contacts with members of the different centrist German political parties, including the Catholic one. So he was a fairly right-wing conservative person anyway. So when the Nazis come to power, he is similar to other German men of his generation in that they're patriots, they love Germany, and they're not Nazis. So he is with that group of men. But younger men in the mosque, younger German converts to Islam, are becoming Nazis. And the danger is from those men, because those younger German Muslims are talking to the Gestapo. And you read the Gestapo reports, which of course are not true, they're propaganda, but the Gestapo reports from around that time, the early 1930s, 1935, claim that the mosque is a hotbed of Judaism. And it's a place where and they use all kinds of derogatory terms saying that it's filled with Jews. This isn't true. I mean, Marcus, yes, but that's about it. So Marcus then, 1935, 1936, decides to disappear. So even though members of the mosque community, especially the Indian Muslims who had established, the British Indian Muslims who had established the mosque, vote for him and want him to be the leader of the German Muslim community, and also want him to continue to give lectures in the mosque, he disappears. He goes, he stops attending the mosque. He resigns his position in the Jewish community. In Germany, of course, you become a member of an accepted religious community by paying, you declare it with the government. So he declares to the government that he's resigning, he's quitting membership in the Jewish community. It's clearly under duress. So then he is still there in Berlin. Perhaps he's even spending time at the house that's connected to the mosque where the imam lives. But officially, he's living with his mother. One of his brothers has committed suicide. Another of his brothers will be arrested and sent to a concentration camp where he will die. Marcus is still living with his mother. He's living with his mother. Now it's as late as 1938, right? So he's a middle-aged man. He's a German patriot, no matter how bad things are. You know, the Nazis even take away his typewriter. No matter how bad things are, he remains in Germany. He cannot believe, this is my interpretation. He cannot believe what is happening. He believes that his Muslim friends in the mosque he cannot believe what is happening. And then the Night of Broken Glass happens. November 9th, November 10th, 1938. And Marcus is arrested, along with thousands of other Berlin Jews. He's arrested as a Jew, not as a gay man, which is lucky, because the gay men that were incarcerated in Sachsenhausen, Marcus is incarcerated in Sachsenhausen after the Night of Broken Glass. The gay men who were imprisoned there suffered an almost 100% death rate. So the gay men who were arrested were almost to a man worked to death and abused and murdered. Marcus is not arrested as a gay man. He's certainly not arrested as a Muslim. The Nazis are not arresting Muslims. They are not persecuting Muslims as Muslims. He's arrested as a Jew, and he's abused and he's mistreated in the camp, but they let him go. And according to the Soviet records, the Soviets liberated the camp, and then the records there. According to the records, he was in the camp about 10 days. Now, 10 days is horrible. He didn't know whether he was going to live or be killed. Nevertheless, after about 10 days, they released him, telling him to leave all of his wealth and property behind and quit the country as soon as he could. Or the next time they put him in the camp, he will never leave. So they threaten him. They say they're going to kill him unless he leaves the country. So what does Marcus do? He goes back home to Wilmersdorf or Charlottenburg, and where he was, and he remains. He doesn't leave the country. He lives with his elderly mother, and he works on the Quran translation. you're reading this and you're thinking, look at what's happening around you. Now, it wasn't easy, of course. It was extremely difficult, of course, for a middle-aged German Jew to leave the country in 1938, 1939. Who's going to take them in? It was extremely difficult. He and his mother surrendered all of their wealth and property. Then they are moved. It's hard to follow the pattern. It's hard to follow, but it looks like the two of them were then moved to what was called a Jewish house, apartment buildings that were taken over and where Nazis basically concentrated Jews prior to their being deported to the camps after that. So he and his mother were there, and he's working away on the Quran translation into German. But it's at this point that he uses his international network of gay, Jewish, and Muslim people to escape the country. So the imam of the mosque manages to secure for him a pass that states that he's not a threat to the Nazi Reich. And that's because his imam serves as character witness. So with that permission, he is able to leave the country, because then the Muslim community, the Ahmadi, his mosque community in British India, provide him a passport. They provide him a passport to British India. So with the paper that says he's not a threat to the regime. And with his British visa, he actually leaves the country. But he manages most likely to take a train to Switzerland. Now, why does he go to Switzerland? Why doesn't he go to Hamburg and take a steamer to India? Well, this was dangerous, though. This was very dangerous because there are other German Jews we know who boarded ships in Hamburg, but then whose ships were returned to Hamburg and they were deported to Auschwitz and murdered. So that was a dangerous route to go because this is, we're speaking in the autumn, this is in the late summer of 1939, just about 10 days before the Second World War breaks out, Marcus shows up in Switzerland. So had he waited another 10 days, or had he not been able to get out another 10 days, he would have been stuck in Germany and he would have been murdered along with his mother. But what happens instead is that he makes it to Switzerland and he has this British passport. But 10 days later, the war breaks out and the passport's canceled. So he escapes to Switzerland. Now we know during the war that Switzerland, according to what we understand, Switzerland allowed about 20,000 people like Marcus, German Jews, into the country and saved their lives. But it turned back at its borders about 20,000 German Jews who were murdered. So the Swiss record is mixed. But Marcus makes it into Switzerland, and he goes to Basel. He goes to actually Basel Land, so the canton outside the city of Basel. And there, we're not sure why, but he's allowed to remain. In fact, he remains in Basel the rest of his life to 1966. So from 1939 to 1966, he remains in Basel or Basel Land, so the canton of Basel outside the city itself. So he used his gay network to secure his stay there. A gay friend would send him money. The Jewish community, he had family in Zurich. They would support him financially. And also the Ahmadi, this British Indian Muslim community that established the mosque in Berlin, to which he was a member, they also would support him until the 1950s. So again, it's the gay, the Jewish, and the Muslim networks which allow him to live really a very long and prosperous life despite all the difficulties. And somehow, we don't know how, he managed to bring his mother to Switzerland as well. At the end of 1939, after the war broke out, an elderly, not very healthy Jewish woman. I don't know how, I haven't been able to find out how, but probably using the same networks, he brings her to Switzerland and she's able to live out just a few years, but the rest of her life in dignity, in peace, and she passes away in Zurich.
And I mean, we're coming to a close slowly, and I want to ask you, I mean, when I was reading the book, I already thought that you were such a capturing author, I couldn't stop reading, and also listening to you're also a very capturing storyteller in as well. How do you do that?
Well, it's the story that moves the writer. So it's not me. It's a story of his life. It has so many contradictions. You know, German, Muslim, Jewish, gay, and his bringing all these different elements together in his fiction and as well as in his real life. It's his life story pushes it. But to be honest, it did take me, I started working on this book around 2009 when I was in Berlin, and the book was published in 2020. So that gives you an idea of how much effort it took me to read through the material was difficult, not because it's in German, although some of the philosophical material in German, even though it's published, is head spinning because Marcus doesn't think like other people think about people such as Nietzsche or Goethe. So you read it and you say, well, what is he saying here? So working with his philosophical material was difficult. But the other problem was his handwriting. So his handwriting deteriorated over the years. And then, like I mentioned, it's no joke. The Nazis took away his typewriter. So then he could only write by hand. And his writing was pretty undecipherable. I mean, he was born in 1880, so already he wrote in almost a different script to what you learn in Germany today anyway, right? I couldn't decipher, for example, the letters that he exchanged with his mother at the end of her life, which would be very revealing, but they're literally undecipherable. I don't know if she could read what he wrote either. So we do have those. I was lucky that after he passed away, his Nachlass was turned over to the Central Library in Zurich. So any researcher can go and can read his private papers in comfort there in the very fine facility of the Central Library of Zurich. And they also have collected his published work, as well as all of his unpublished papers are there. So the material's been there for a long time, but it took someone such as myself, it took someone with the curiosity to read through it and to tell the story that I do.
Well, thank you very much for this great conversation, Mark David Baer. We talked about German Jew, Muslim, gay, the life and times of Hugo Marcus. And this is New Books Network. My name is Armand Childers. Until next time.